I'm your host, Jenny Worthington, and I will be introducing you to people and organizations around the world who are working for animal welfare. We're being called to participate in making the world a better place, and the people I will be talking with are on the front lines of critical work that we need to know about so that we can support them. I hope you enjoy, and thanks for listening. Hi, welcome back to Hello Animal Talks. I'm Jenny Worthington, and I'm bringing you incredible people and organizations from around the world who are working for animal welfare. And today I'm really excited to have with me Mark Hofberg, who is a campaign manager for the International Fund for Animal Welfare in Washington, D.C. His main work is with promoting peaceful coexistence between humans and wildlife across the United States. So welcome, Mark.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming. So give us a little starter on how you got involved with wildlife welfare and with International Fund for Animal Welfare.
Sure. I got my master's degree in conservation biology and environmental policy at Maryland. And right after I graduated, I applied to this internship at International Fund for Animal Welfare. And over time, I went from intern to staff member and now to, you know, officer manager. So just kind of came up through hard work and love of animals.
I think that's great. You pretty much started from the get-go with International Fund for Animal Welfare.
Yeah.
But I saw in your bio that you worked with pangolins.
Yeah.
And they are not native North American animals, are they?
No. So earlier in my career with IFAW, I did a lot more work on international species and international issues. So actually, pangolins was the first thing I worked on at IFAW. So this is back in 2015. And I mean, pangolins are still a little bit under the radar, but back then nobody knew what they were.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about them.
Sure. They're awesome animals. There's 8 species, 4 in Asia and 4 in Africa, and they are the most trafficked mammal in the world. They're highly prized for, one, they're kind of considered a delicacy in some cultures. So think of it like lobster on steroids. So you know how you'd go to a dinner to impress your boss, you'd order lobster or something. It's like that, except times 10, as far as like price. And then the other side of it is their scales. This is one of the things that makes them so unique, is they're covered in scales. They're the only mammal that has scales. And these scales are made of the same keratin, the same chemical that's your fingernail, but they're considered medicine in some cultures that treat a wide variety of things. And so you'll find powdered pangolin scales for sale in many places, in the U.S., in China, Vietnam, a lot of places. And so with pangolins, the species that are in Asia have essentially been depleted, especially the Chinese pangolin, which is used to be found in China. And then there's this Sunda pangolin, which is Southeast Asia. So they're critically endangered. And then the trade kind of moved to India and the Philippines, the demand, and then also to Africa. And so there's this intercontinental smuggling, huge scale, right? When I first started looking at this, we would see seizures for a couple tons of either pangolin frozen bodies or scales. Now they're multiple tons, 10, 20 tons that are, you know, seized in Hong Kong or seized in Nigeria airport or wherever. And the volume is really quite staggering. And we actually have no idea how many are left because they are solitary and they're mostly nocturnal and they're hard to find, right? It's not like elephants. We can't just fly a plane over a savanna and count the elephants, right?
Right.
And count pangolins. But we, based on reports from locals and also just the sheer volume and estimates, we can tell that they're beginning pretty bad. And so back in 2015, I co-wrote a petition to list there's only one species listed on the U.S. Endangered Species Act. We petitioned to list the other 7, and that still we haven't heard anything back from the U.S. government on that. So we're waiting on that. It's been 6 years now. That was that. And then but the good news is that, I don't know how much you know about CITES, it's the international body that governs the trade of species that are, you know, traded. In 2016, in the Conference of Parties in Johannesburg, we were able to get all 8 species listed on Appendix 1, which is the highest form of protection. Okay. And that was huge, because at the time there was a couple loopholes. So African species were only on Appendix 2. And also, it's unless you do a DNA test, which is not really feasible for the amounts of shipments we see, you can't tell the difference between with any kind of regularity between 2 scales.
Right.
Or especially in the powder form, which is what we see a lot.
Right.
And so there was a lot of, oh, this is African species when we know it's one of the Asian species. So having them all on Appendix 1 makes it so enforcement's a lot easier. And we can just say, no, you can't trade this unless you have these permits, which are hard to get from the import and export country.
Right. So that's the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Is that what it is?
Yeah. There's a longer name for it. It's
But it's basically sort of, it's an international agreement between countries.
It's a treaty.
A treaty.
Yeah. So, you know, like all the parties to it, I think there's 193 countries. Most countries in the world are party to it. You know, we're bound by, at least the U.S. is bound by law to enforce the appendices or what comes out of CITES.
Right. And that includes what is imported to the U.S. from other countries?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Appendix 1 specifically, if a species is listed on Appendix 1, in order to be imported into the United States, for example, you would have to have an export permit from the country, and you'd have to have an import permit from the U.S. And the U.S. has to prove that this import does not, I can't remember the exact language, but is not a detriment to the conservation of the species, which is hard to do, right? Yeah. Especially a species that we know is in trade and is being hurt by trade, right?
Right, and is already endangered, yeah.
Yeah. But for example, like a tiger skin or something, right?
Right.
You'd have to get an import permit from the United States that says that importing this tiger skin does not harm the species, when there's no way. I mean, there's only 10,000 in the wild, so you cannot say that.
Yeah. So interesting. Well, that's a huge accomplishment to get them put on the appendix.
Yeah. And that was, I would say, like, that was a really defining moment in my career, because, I mean, I was only 2016. I mean, that was a year and a half into my really professional career.
Wow.
And I was in South Africa, and by a fluke, I spoke at the plenary, and they basically, it was like the NGOs, like the nonprofits like us, they only get a little bit of time.
Yeah.
And you're kind of picked at random, which NGOs, there's a lot of NGOs there. And my boss happened to be, he was like, oh, there's no way they'll pick us. I need to go do something, talk to somebody. And I was the one at the table, and I, the camera's on me. There's hundreds of people in there, dignitaries from every single country in the world, basically. And I'm like,
oh my God, that's huge.
Yeah. That was quite a moment from, you know, personally, and then also for the species as well.
Absolutely. Wow, that's incredible. Well, I've seen pictures of, like, these shipments, people like Paul Hilton, who's a big photographer.
Oh, yeah.
And he has these pictures that just are, it's like you say, it's unbelievable. I can't imagine seeing it in person. Seeing it in a picture is bad enough, but seeing it in person.
Oh, yeah, I've seen his pictures. If I remember correctly, we've use some of his pictures for our, you know, materials, and the huge pits, they just have to dig huge pits to put all the bodies in and burn it. It's really sad.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah. So that's huge. And kind of fun for me, because I only learned about pangolins just a couple of years ago. I didn't know anything about them.
Oh, when I started, I mean, believe me, I didn't, had no idea what they were. And then my friends would ask me what I'm doing. I'm like, how much time do you have? I had a picture on my phone ready to go.
Yeah.
Because if you give me a minute to gush a little bit, they're one of the most unique animals in the world. They're essentially living fossils. They split from Carnivora, Order Carnivora, 60 million years ago. And carnivore is like a big order. It's got includes canines and includes cats. So if you, huge order, right?
Right.
And so they're more closely related to a cat than they are like anything else. It's crazy.
Wow.
And so they're just so unique and so specialized. And then they're just, they don't harm anybody. Their defense mechanism is to roll up in a ball.
Yeah, they remind me of armadillos.
So they're a little bit of coevolution with armadillos. They're, you know, they eat, depending on what species, and they eat insects, mostly termites or ants and things like that. The one of the species has a tail that it uses to climb trees like a monkey.
Mm-hmm.
One of the species looks like a T-Rex.
Oh.
Maybe seen photos. The one that lives in Savannah, the Cape one, is like big claws, and there's just like yeah, and they have so many specialized evolutionary traits, like their tongues, so like an anterior tongue, you know, very long, and it like sits in their abdomen. It's so long.
Wow.
And it, when it comes out, it gets covered with the sticky, you know. They're just very, very unique animals. And I've seen videos, their scales are so strong.
Yeah.
I've seen videos of lions like basically playing with them like a ball.
Oh wow.
They're like big, you know, giant lion and this little pangolin. But they can't get through the armor.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they're just very unique. So it was easy to fall in love and easy to,
yeah.
to advocate for them, for sure.
That's incredible. Wow. Well, congratulations on that. We'll all have to go learn more about pangolins and make sure that we're not buying anything that has pangolin powder in it.
For sure, yeah. I mean, and...
is that labeled as something different?
You can see it as... anteater. Oh. If you see anything with anteater, I mean, obviously pangolin, anything with scale.
Okay.
In the U.S., I mean, mostly you would find it in a powdered, it would look like medicine. It would look like a you could find it online. It's, but again, it's illegal.
Yeah.
To import into the United States. And so shouldn't be there.
Okay, good. Okay, well, let's move on to the United States then.
Sure.
And so you're working for a peaceful coexistence between humans and animal populations, which would be things like coyotes, wolves, bears, foxes, maybe any kind of animal that where the human populations butt up against the animal populations, and there's a potential for problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So essentially, there's something called human wildlife conflict, and that's a bucket that a lot of things are put in, and it's, you know, a global thing. And in the U.S., it's kind of interesting. We expect, you know, we love elephants in Africa, we love lions in Africa, and we expect people to live with them because we want to save the elephants and the lions. Uh-huh. But here in the United States, the reaction to things like our analogs of that, which would be like wolves or coyotes, is shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what we advocate for is, one, it's healthier for not only for the animal and for the environment, a more balanced ecosystem. It's also healthy for you and for people to have these apex predators or mesopredators like foxes and coyotes to help in the ecosystem. And so we have to find a way to not shoot our way out of a problem, right? And specifically with wolves, that is a little more complicated because wolves are, you know, they're on or off the endangered species list depending on what population or what day of the week it is, really. And so I don't know if we really want to get into that as much, but essentially with some of the other species, and then with wolves, it's more of a like a politics thing, right? Unfortunately.
Right. And I did want to ask you, are they currently on the endangered species list or not? I know we just had like a thousand wolves that were, they were trying to get rid of 1,000 wolves. Just
it depends on the population.
Yeah.
I'd have to touch up on it again because it does change a lot. There are populations where they should be on the list and they're not. They're not recovered. They've come back and they are recovering.
Yeah.
But we're not at the point where, anywhere near the point where we need to be thinking about population control. But with some of other species, like coyotes and beavers and foxes, the first response to, and you see it in especially things like Facebook groups and Nextdoor and, you know, neighborhood listservs and things like that, is, oh my God, there's a fox in the neighborhood. What do we do about it? Uh-huh. So we're here to answer that question, because there is a lot of misunderstanding. And there's a lot of misunderstanding of the risks associated with an animal like that. Also, there's a lot more of them than you see. So one of the things we do is try to educate people on what the risks are, which, and they're very small, but, you know, you should know. And then also what to do when you see a coyote or when you see a fox, something that can be dangerous, but if you're taking the right actions, then you can minimize that risk. Because we don't want to lie and say that, I mean, coyotes have, it's very, very rare, but they do attack people, right? Very rare situations. Black bears, I mean, I think just yesterday we had a story of a woman being killed by a black bear in Canada. Uh-huh. It does happen, right? Uh-huh. But what we don't want to have is that being the overall, those rare stories being the overall messaging, right? It's like with sharks. I mean, it's similar. If someone gets killed by a shark, everyone knows.
Yep.
Right. But the thousands and thousands and thousands of sharks that are swimming up and down the shore daily that we don't hear about.
Yeah.
We don't, you know, frankly, the dog attacks that happen every day, we don't hear about those, right?
Right. Oh, true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So not that I want to, you know, compare apples to oranges, but the point is that it is a bit mischaracterized, and stories that do come out do become sensationalized.
Right.
So we want to combat that a little bit. And then the second part of it, and I think this is the main coexistence part, is there are so many things that we should be doing as a society to, one, prevent these situations from happening at all, or at least reducing the chance to negligible, and two, protecting them and appreciating the fact that we get to live with animals. I mean, it really is great that even in a world where we've urbanized and suburbanized huge parts of this country, we are still, these animals find a way to live in human areas. They live in our backyards and they live in the spaces between the houses, and coyotes, I mean, they can live in little urban parks, and their territories are just, you know, the little bits between the urban parks. We should appreciate that.
Yeah, it's amazing how adaptable they are. I mean,
especially coyotes. I mean, it's amazing. And there are the things that we need to do. For example, make sure it all boils down to a coexistence, really, is don't feed them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is literally the most important thing that we can say.
Yeah.
And it could be intentional feeding, or it could be unintentional feeding. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Intentional feeding tends to be with like deer. Okay. People like will feed, you know, put the food out for the deer, so they want to see the deer.
Right.
I that's not a good idea, but it also doesn't lead to deer attacks. Deer.
Right.
When we're talking about animals that are a little stronger, like bears or coyotes or anything like that, then it's important for public safety. And we're talking about making sure your trash is covered. We're talking about bird feeders. In a lot of areas, it's really a bad idea to have any kind of bird feeder. Have a bird bath instead. Okay.
Interesting. I would never have thought of the bird feeder.
Because, I mean, a smart animal like a coyote, I mean, that's a snack, right? And then they'll come back for more, and then they become habituated, which is the thing that we're trying to prevent the most.
Right.
Once an animal is habituated, it can be dangerous for everyone, the animal and for people.
Explain what habituated is for people that might not know.
Sure. So habituation is when an animal comes to see either a person or people or an area that they shouldn't be in. So for example, like someone's back porch or something, mm-hmm. anything where they shouldn't be as an area they can be, or they associate it with food. So if they associate your back porch with trash that you leave out, or maybe you go and eat food in your patio all the time, and then you leave something there, and then they get food and they come back and there's more food, they know that your backyard is the place to be.
Right. And they get used to you too.
Yes. And they get used to you.
Yeah.
And so the things that we preach are essentially, don't provide those food sources. And if you see a coyote, you want to, the technical term is called hazing. Uh-huh. And we always try to explain that because it doesn't sound great, right? But you want to make that animal uncomfortable, because mm-hmm. you don't want it to associate, you know, you with comfort. And so that can mean banging pots and pans, making yourself large and yelling. One of the things is to throw something near it. Mm-hmm. I only suggest that if you have good aim, because you don't want to actually hit it. And then there's, you know, so those are kind of the two main things that we suggest. And then with each individual animal, it's important to know if they're in your area. So you know, okay, it's coyote pupping season. So if I see a coyote, it's a high chance that it's a mama with some cubs or pups, right? Mm-hmm. And that means they're extra defensive. So that means maybe don't haze this time, maybe just slowly back away, right? As you can see, there's a lot of information there, right? That I just gave you a lot of information.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so something that we're struggling with and trying to work hard with is, how do we give that information out mm-hmm. in a way that is easily comprehensible and easily to remember?
Well, it is very simple information, you know, it's commonsensical, really.
Right. Which is why we latch onto the preventing the food sources, because that is the easiest thing to think about. And also with hazing, you know, there's some gray area, right? If there are cubs around, then it might not be a good idea. Mm-hmm. With removing food sources, I mean, it's 100% always.
Yeah.
Always a good idea.
Yeah.
And no intentional feeding, please. Please.
Yeah. I have a coop of chickens, and I put their food out during the day, and I always make sure to put it inside the coop at night so that it's not just hanging out there as a, a beacon to everybody to come have a good time.
And those chickens are a beacon too.
Yeah, they are. They're a beacon already. I have an agreement with our coyotes though, that they're okay in the woods, but they're not to come down and eat anything.
Yeah. And coyotes are smart, right? You know, it's not like, you know, you can go and tell them that, but we know a lot of cases they learn mm-hmm. that what is acceptable, what's where they can be and where they can't be, mm-hmm. because coyotes are a species that basically it's all risk calculation to them. Mm-hmm. They will, if something is low risk and high reward, then they'll go for it. They're opportunists. If it's high risk, then they won't. There's plenty of other things for them to eat. They eat berries, they eat plant matter, they eat woodland mice. Actually, most of their diet is small rodents, which is, you know, great. It's great for that's part of why they're important, mm-hmm. is they are a check on some species. So yeah, I mean, that's a great point.
Okay, so how about the people that say, well, you know, I have this, my dog is so important to me, or my cat, and I know that, you know, coyotes are around. What do you say about them? They, you know, they don't want the coyote coming in and snacking on their pets.
I'm in D.C. now, but I live mostly in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. On 5 acres, and there's a black bear that does come around. I know there are coyotes. I have a 15-pound dog, and I understand that I am in an area that has animals that could eat my dog, right? And so I act accordingly. During the day, whenever I let my dog out, I am with him, uh-huh. you know, within a couple meters of him. Uh-huh. At night, I don't, you know, I'm very close. I have a flashlight with me, always leashed. To me, it's, those are the small prices that I pay mm-hmm. in order to be in an area that has these animals. I'm doing my part, I guess. It's not very much, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not like, you know, I'm just doing the bare minimum here and not having food sources, right?
Right.
Opening my trash. My trash is all in the garage. You know, I don't leave it out, things like that. And I do sympathize with people who have pets, because I'm a small pet myself, but it's just the small actions that you take. And I just want to reiterate, I don't minimize, you know, I don't want to minimize people suffering, because, you know, they do take pets sometimes, right? but what we can do is our best to reduce the risk of that happening. Right. I'm never going to say it's never going to happen, but we can take very simple and easy steps to protect ourselves, our pets, and wildlife at the same time. It's really, the efficiency of it is pretty beautiful, right?
Yeah, and it's all totally doable. We just have to be aware of it and practice it.
Yeah.
Give us an idea of how it's important to have these animals around. Like, why do we care?
So besides the intrinsic value of wildlife, so just their existence is there's a value in that in itself. Just knowing that the animals are in the area, right? They have their own value. But then there's also the value to us, right? They are, in many cases, integral parts of the ecosystem, especially mesopredators like coyotes and foxes. Since we don't have wolves anymore in our area, in the eastern seaboard where we both are,
right.
These places evolved to have a top predator like wolves. And we haven't had wolves for a long time. By having a mesopredator like foxes and coyotes, they can help provide that ecosystem niche that has been left by us eradicating wolves.
Okay.
You know, what 100 years ago, whatever it was. And that is important because I hate to say balance because it's kind of reductionist, but an ecosystem that has all of its niches does all of the ecosystem services: clean water, clean air, flood retention, soil diversity, and soil retention, so for crops and things like that, cleaning groundwater that comes from rain before it gets into the river, pest control, right? So if we have the right amount of animals of different niches, we're not going to have too much of one thing. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get pests, right?
Right.
And so it's the same thing, like, if you think about it, like, if you have enough bats in an area, then you don't have too much of the insects that are flying insects that are annoying or whatever.
Right.
If you have enough coyotes and foxes, then you don't have too much of the ground mice, which can, if there's too many of them, then, you know, there can be issues with either crops or ecosystems, right? And so it's all connected, right? And we're talking about a huge part of these ecosystems is that middle to top level predator that tends to be vilified, right?
Yeah.
And we need it. We need it for ourselves. There is some research on, and there's some hypothesis on, the connection between Lyme disease and the lack of predators in the Northeast and Southeast, because one of the stages of the ticks that carry Lyme disease or life cycle is on small mammals, like little mice and things like that. And so when you have an overabundance of those things, then they think that that's something that can cause a lot of Lyme disease in an area. The research is still pending on that, but it kind of just shows you how connected these things are. And that one change in, you know, oh, we don't want coyotes because, you know, they could attack people or they could attack pets. Well, that, guess what? Well, first of all, you can't get rid of them. They're coyotes. Yeah. Good luck. Two, even if you could flip a switch and take them all out, it would be, you know, you would have problems in other areas. The ecosystem is all connected.
Right, right. So if you got rid of the coyotes, then whatever they're hunting, that would increase, and then that would create a problem farther down the line, and it just builds on itself. And
exactly.
And then we're creating it. So a healthy wild environment is healthy for us.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's connected to our health. And like I mentioned, all those ecosystem services, they're all based on a healthy ecosystem.
Right, right, right.
So it's kind of, you know, it's a lot of, you know, connections, but eventually it does connect back to us.
Yeah, it does. And I think we're just totally unaware of that most of the time. I was really interested to read one of your wolf articles, how you mentioned, I believe it was you that wrote it. When you're hunting a social animal like a wolf and you're completely disrupting their family structure, then you are throwing that entire system out of balance just within that wolf pack. And then that's creating issues that make them more
aggressive,
more likely to interact with us.
Yeah.
because they can't hunt as well. They come down into agricultural places or down into urban areas. Does that ring a bell to you?
Yeah.
I thought that was so interesting because I had not thought of it that way. But just the disruption in the family dynamic.
With wolves, if you think about like a stable pack, and then if you kill the pack leader, then you have a lot of outcasts that end up happening because then the new alpha has to kick out all the competition. Mm-hmm. And so then you have a bunch of hungry young males, essentially, that don't know what they're doing. And that's not good for anybody. So then, you know, instead of pack hunting elk in Yellowstone, they'll go and try to get a calf in someone's ranch.
Right.
So, and then with coyotes, there's actually an interesting study on this. So coyotes specifically adjust their birth rate based on the number of available territories or the amount of territory that's available to them. So if you say, oh, let's try to shoot as many coyotes as we can, and we have, there's data on this. You kill a bunch of coyotes, the ones that remain will actually reproduce more.
Wow.
And then instead of having X amount of mature coyotes that have established territories and know what they're doing, you have X amount of young coyotes that are exploring and finding new territory and don't understand the landscape and don't have that partnership that you have with your local coyote, right? They may try to attack your chickens because they don't know that this isn't where you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
They haven't learned that yet because they're, so they've actually seen, you know, with coyote calls, they'll see an increase in negative behavior the next year.
Wow, that's so amazing. It's so similar to humans. You know, right. If you don't keep the mature populations to teach the new generations coming up how to behave, then you end up with all these rogue, crazy young people who have no idea what in the world is the correct behavior for a society. Like the elephants are the same way when they have, you know, these rogue male teenagers that don't have the old bulls to teach them proper etiquette.
Yeah, you see a lot in what we call fission-fusion family groups where it's, you know, it's like with wolves, with packs and with lion prides and things like that, where they break apart and come back, and it's all based on family dynamics.
Right.
If you don't have that, you know, institutional, I mean, it's interesting to think about animals like that because it really is pretty institutional, essentially.
Yeah.
Then you don't have the guardrails that they normally have. Yes. I mean, that's one of the reasons why with coyotes specifically, I mean, not only are you not doing anything positive by killing coyotes because, I mean, not only are you not accomplishing the goal that you think you are, that you want to accomplish, which would be for coyote calls, the goal would be to reduce the number of coyotes in the area, right? You're not even accomplishing that because the next year there's going to be the same amount. You just wasted taxpayer money and wasted lives and wasted pain and suffering. You're also causing problems.
Yeah, because, you're making it much worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so interesting.
Wow. So, with coyotes, it's like you better learn how to get along with them or you're just going to waste money and cause suffering, right? So coyotes is a little different messaging than we're used to because they're really not at risk of any kind of extinction in whatsoever because they're so adaptable.
Yeah.
I mean, it would take a monumental effort to even dent, you know, what's going on with them, with their population. It's more of a like coexistence. Like, let's find a way to live in a way that reduces the suffering for humans and animals and supports the positive aspects of that relationship.
Right.
You know, with elephants and lions and wolves, it's a little different because not only do you have that, they're also endangered.
Right.
They're also imperiled species.
Right.
So there's also the added part of it, which is, well, there's only so many of them left, so we better protect them.
Right. So I personally love wolves. I just love them. I love the whole family structure and the way everything works together. And I hear differing things about, like you brought up the elk population. And I talked to Cheryl Fink, who's also at IFAL, the other day, and they're having the same issue, or they're claiming to have an issue with the caribou up there, where they're saying that the wolves are killing all the caribou. So they're putting out all these cyanide bombs and stuff. I know I've heard that it's a similar situation with the elk, where it's being claimed that the elk population is being decimated by the wolves, and so the wolves need to be hauled as well. Is that true?
I would just point to the fact that for millions of years, I mean, hundreds of thousands, whatever you want to say, wolves and elk evolved together without, you know, humans adjusting one population or the other. If wolves had the ability to eradicate caribou or elk populations, then they would have. And also, I mean, that goes back to stability of the pack. You know, in general, they're going for the young or sick. And the answer is what they're really saying is that we want less wolves because we want to shoot more elk.
Right.
In Canada, I think the caribou are, they imperiled or endangered or something. I was going to say, talk to Cheryl because she knows so much about this. We have the same issue with seals.
She told me about that. Yeah, the cod. They said, the cod industry has gone down. It must be the
because seals. Of seals.
Yeah. And the whole thing is, too, with that is, like, I'm thinking, okay, well, a predator isn't going to decimate his prey because then he's not going to have anything to live on. So, you know, they're just not going to do that.
And, you know, and it's an evolutionary thing. They've evolved together at this point, you know, and the science shows it too. I mean, it's, you know, logically, and if you look at the science, I'm pretty sure that Cheryl probably would have told you about I think there's a study that showed that wolves aren't, there are a small effect on the population of caribou.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then on the coast, you know, with seals, it's the same deal with fisheries. I mean, the share of population that is, like, reduced by the fish population that is reduced by seals is minuscule.
Yeah.
Especially compared to the amount that we humans fish up and
right.
You know. Yeah. I mean, those arguments are, you know, there's a kernel of truth to them, and that yes, wolves do hunt caribou and they do hunt elk.
Yeah.
But it's a question of magnitude and effect on the population as a whole.
And also the industry that's sort of wanting to stay alive, like such as the, you know, the hunting industry and
all
that stuff, fishing industry.
Yeah, it's right. So, you know, special interest groups and things like that. Yeah. You have to understand, like, what the interests are and why they would say that.
Right.
But you mentioned sodium cyanide bombs. The U.S. government does use those.
They do. Yeah.
They do.
Yeah. Government sanctioned.
I can't remember if it's specific, if they use them on wolves or if that's not allowed, but they definitely use them on coyotes. And it's just, they're horrible. So essentially they're baited for canine. So they smell good for canines. And then what they'll do is they're like little things, and then the animal will bite on it, and then it'll be cyanide will be injected into their mouths. Yeah. And it's just a very painful death, very graphic. And there's been lots of evidence of untargeted, you know, non-target death, whether it be other animals, wild animals, or pets.
Yeah.
People's dogs have been killed by these bombs because, you know, there's not enough signage or, you know, put them on public land and things like that. It's pretty sad.
And wasn't it Canyon, the young child with his dog?
Are you going to talk to Carson?
I did talk to Carson.
Okay, you did.
About it. Yeah.
I'm sure she would have mentioned that. Yeah, the Canyon was with his dog, and they were like in their backyard. You know, not technically it was public land, but it butts up to their backyard. And then the dog found a bomb. Yeah, the cyanide got on Canyon too. It's just the methods that we use to solve problems are pretty barbaric, and they don't do anything. It's just, yeah. It's infuriating.
It's just cruel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a bill that we're pushing, Carson specifically, one of her main things is a bill to make it so we can't put those sodium cyanide bombs on public land, which is, again, it's a slice of the problem.
Yeah. How about, okay, so we've covered the coyotes and a little bit on the beavers. So what do you do about beavers if you have beavers in your area? Like, what do people complain about with the beavers? That they're damming up their stream and flooding?
Yeah, they can cause property damage, right? Because they dam streams and then the flooding, right?
So,
and the answer to that in the past and now is usually some sort of trap. And in a lot of cases, they can't be moved anywhere because they're technically could have rabies or something like that. So a lot of them are lethal traps, and some of them are really inhumane. They'll drowning traps, and drowning an animal that is a water, aquatic animal, is really painful. The thing is, there are methods to prevent the damage that a dam would cause. So you can put little flow valves in their dams, so they don't actually create the distilled water at the top.
Okay.
So the water can continue to flow, but the dam is still there.
Right.
And so we try to push for non-lethal solutions like that.
Yeah. And how about the bears?
Well, real quick for beavers.
Oh, beavers, yeah.
They are so important for ecosystems. Like, when we say keystone species, we're talking keystone species. The dams that they create introduce variability into ecosystems that really need it. Basically, the more variability you have, the more the healthier the ecosystem.
Right.
So I would say, like, with them, it's a matter of not just animal welfare concern, it is really a conservation concern.
Okay, it has a wide net effect on the rest of the ecosystem.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And do those flow valves, do they actually prevent a pond from being formed? Or it just sort of keeps the pond from getting so big?
I think that's the main thing, is that you're going to have some pond formation. I think it's more of a, to prevent an entire area from being flooded.
Right. Because they need the ponds, don't they? Yeah. They wouldn't make the dams if they didn't need the ponds, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure. For black bears, it's a little different because they're, they are a little more, they're big animals, and they can fast, and they're dangerous, right? And the other thing about black bears is, you can't just cover your trash. You got to have a bear-safe trash can.
Right.
And that space is definitely a little more explored. So government agencies do a really good job of education, but they don't have enough funding to do that, right? So they know and they understand the need to educate people on how to be bear safe, but I think they need more funding, and they need the ability. So with bears, I think we find our role is more of an amplification. They have these brochures. I mean, I remember we visited one state agency, and they have these brochures that tell you what to do if you see a bear. They say how to prepare for it, get bear mace, things like that. But it's this little brochure. It's not even online.
Oh.
That's all they have the funding to do, right?
Wow.
And so we see as our job is to spread the message.
Right.
Yeah. So with bears, it really is, if there's an area where, there's black bears, and on the East Coast, it's more, obviously it's black bears. Having bear mace and understanding how to use bear mace is probably a good thing. Knowing what to do in a situation. If it's a season where there's cubs, being aware of that. So there's a lot of information out there that I definitely suggest people read up on black bears before they go to, hiking and stuff like that.
Yeah. I know that they've been spottings here near us of bears in the area. So,
Which is exciting, right?
It's super exciting. Yeah. Although I think, if I'm walking in my woods, I don't know that I'd be super psyched to
go out.
I'd have to sing the entire way or something to scare.
Well, that's the balance, right?
And how about my sister lives in Colorado, and they have mountain lions, and, like, she showed me a video somebody had taken of just in her neighborhood walking along the sidewalk, And I know that, you know, she goes walking her dog all the time up in the mountain area. I mean, she's on a mountain, she goes farther up. And I know that they're really good stalkers. You know, they can be there without you knowing that they're there. Yeah. You know, I always worry for the mountain lion. Because if something happens, you know, they're going to come in and they're going to kill the mountain lion.
Yeah. And that, so with animals like bears and mountain lions that are predators, right? So there's definitely more of a whole community approach that needs to happen, because those animals need space. And we do this, this is work. We don't really do this work as much in the United States. We do a lot of this work in, we do this with jaguars in South America. We do this with, in Mexico. We do this with lions in Africa, elephants. Elephants aren't predators, but they can crush people. You know.
Right.
Elephants in Africa, cheetahs as well. So it's a more of a community approach. It's not just a personal responsibility thing, because there needs to be space for the animals to have habitat. And also have a plate, have food that they don't need to get. They don't need to go into the community to get their food.
Right.
So, we want them there, but we don't want them to come into our space, right? Or at least not want to. And so that is where you need the entire community doing all of the things that you, you know, protecting your pets, keeping your trash covered, not providing food sources, hazing. It's a lot of different things that need to happen in order for to prevent the conflict that you want to prevent.
Right.
Yeah. And so one example is in Mexico, we have a program called Casitas Azules, which is like little blue houses. And so in Playa del Carmen in Mexico, dog ownership there is a little different than in the United States. You know, they'll let their dogs sleep outside and kind of in the street, but they still, it's more like a outdoor cat. But the issue is that if they're not sleeping in a protected place, then the jaguars would come into the town, especially since there's a lot of development that is pushing into the jungle. Uh-huh. So they're losing their habitat, right? So that's number one. Uh-huh. And number two is the jaguars would see essentially, oh, food source. Stray dogs. So that's doubly bad, because one, we have a habituated jaguar, not good.
Right.
And two, we have a someone's dead pet.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's doubly bad. So we started this program and trying to promote housing of pets so that to keep the pets inside at night and more like personal ownership to prevent that food source from being there. And so, and we've seen it, it does work. The jaguars will go, and then coupled with habitat protection,
right?
And that's the key, because if you don't, they don't have the two things, right? Habitat, mm-hmm, and food,
right?
If they don't need to go in to human areas for either of those, then there won't be an issue.
Yeah,
they'll stay in the jungle,
right? Right,
or they'll stay in the forest.
Yeah, I think that's really important for people to remember that, you know, these animals would not be seeking us out. They wouldn't be wanting to come play in our neighborhoods,
right,
if we hadn't taken away their natural habitat, you know. So I think that's really important to remember.
There was a viral TikTok video that went around of this girl who, like, this poor girl, she had like a couple dogs outside, and then there was a bear with a cub that, like, I think it was definitely on the West Coast somewhere, like was on top of the retaining wall.
Oh.
And the dogs were acting like normal dogs and were trying to defend, right? And there was going to be some conflict, and she like ran out and had to push the bear over. It was crazy.
Oh my gosh.
And like, I would say, and what I said to that is like, good for her, right? But that's very dangerous. We want to avoid that situation. Why is that bear there?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not there because it's just exploring. It's there because its habitat is being decimated.
Right, right.
And there's food sources for it to have in the suburb, right? Yeah. So let's think about the root causes of the issue, you know, and try to prevent as many of these tragic situations as we can.
Mm-hmm. And I think that should also affect people's attitude toward these animals that are coming into, you know, quote, their space, mm-hmm, is that wouldn't be happening if it weren't for us in the first place, and not to take it out on the animal.
Yeah. They're acting their, you know, their instincts, right?
Yeah,
and this is something we talk about, is we are the intelligent species, right? It's up to us to adjust our behavior, right? Yeah. They're not going to adjust their behavior because we ask them to. We have the power to change the way that we, very basic changes, right? The way that we live and the way that we develop our areas and allow green space. That's our responsibility as people.
Right. Totally agree. Okay. Well, I don't want to keep you too long, but I did have one other thing. Cause I know you had an article on, how to prevent another COVID happening.
Oh yeah.
So do you want to get into that or no?
Quickly.
We'll just touch on it.
Yeah. So COVID specifically, I mean, there's still a question of exactly where it came from.
Right.
But so I'll just avoid that because the jury's still out.
Right.
But the amount of zoonotic diseases, which are diseases that came from animals and into people, spilled over into people and became people diseases, the number of those has been increasing over time. The amount of those diseases that come from wildlife have been increasing over time. It's not just, you know, domestic animals. And the research shows that the risk factors for this are sustained contact with wild animals, animals in stressful environments and unnatural wildlife, especially unnatural environments. So caging a bunch of wild animals together is unnatural and this high stress, which leads to shedding, which leads to more transfer of diseases. And what we found is that wildlife trade, so trading in live animal species and to some degree parts and products, checks a lot of those boxes. So if you're putting a bunch of wild animals in a market, you know, in a cage next to other animals, that is essentially exactly the breeding ground that is required to create zoonotic diseases that transfer from people, from animals to people.
Right.
And if you look back on the most deadly diseases in human history, they're zoonotic diseases. So avian flu from the 1918 flu, AIDS, HIV AIDS, bubonic plague, zoonotic disease, SARS, the list, Nipah, the list goes on, right? So we're just playing with fire.
Right.
And so if, and it's like, you know, I whether or not coronavirus came from whichever animal, the risk factors involved are such that the way that we're living our lives right now is it's only a matter of time before another one comes. And so what we need to do is essentially there's a couple things that need to be done on the level of like international trade, but as far as conservation, the live animal trade needs to really be looked at as a risk factor.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, I think it's really great what you're doing because I think it is the only sustainable solution is creating a coexistence that's peaceful for everybody.
Yeah. We're just trying to create a situation where, you know, it's not never going to be perfect, right? There's going to be, you know, problems, but we want to reduce the, you know, those are the symptoms. We want to reduce the underlying factors that lead to those problems.
Yeah.
And it all starts with our behavior and the things that we do.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. I think, you know, we sort of created the mess and supposedly we are intelligent and we're able to figure it out.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, I really appreciate everything you're doing in this area. And is there anything final you want to add?
I don't think so. I think we went through a lot of good stuff today.
Yeah, it's really good. Okay, so we all have our marching orders on how to, you know, take care of things so we avoid unnecessary wildlife conflict and keep a peaceful environment and keep everybody safe and sound.
Yeah, and I would say if you have more questions, you can always go. We have a coexistence page at ifaw.org, okay. ifaw.org.
Okay.
And your local government likely has some resources out there. They're just not promoting them because they don't have the ability, they don't have the money or the time to do it. So if you look for it, they have stuff. They have good stuff out there.
Okay, that's awesome. That's awesome. I just appreciate so much your being here.
Oh, thank you. This was great. This was fun to talk about.
Yeah, it was really fun. Hopefully we can keep in touch. And yeah, I'd love to talk to you again farther down the line.
Yeah, there's always more.
Yeah, see what's going on.
Yeah.
See how far we've progressed. Well, Mark, have a great rest of the day. Take care. Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Hello Animal Talks, hosted by me, Jenny Worthington, production by Stacey Spencer of Going Graphic, sound engineered by Jimmy Richards of Bay Central Media, and music written and performed by Jake Shepard.